You are on the next level. This is The Beautiful Truth on BreakForNews.com, where the expression is still free.
20 seconds and counting. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour.
And you're very welcome. This is The Beautiful Truth on BreakForNews.com with Fintan Dunn reporting. First off, congratulate the American people. Well done, folks. You really scared those guys, and otherwise it would have been politically armed robbery. You know, when it came right down to it, it has nothing to do with the interests of the nation. These people were actually fighting on the floor of the House over who is going to put up sacrificial lambs who might lose their seats at the next election. Democrats saying, hey, too many of our guys' asses are on the line. You got to put some of your guys' asses on the line too. And the Republicans saying, no. It's Spin City out there. So what we'll try to do is to cut through some of the BS and get to the truth of what's been going on. And also just take a look at how we got here and how the 9/11 issue is deeply connected to all of these events. But as I say, first off, congratulations to the American people. Now, the 9/11 issue and the financial crisis are, of course, deeply linked, and we'll get into that in some detail. But I'd like to start off with just a couple of snippets to give you an indication of what's going on. As you may know, it was literally within weeks of the 9/11 event that China was admitted to the World Trade Organization. And we've had the growth of the Chinese economy in the intervening years since 9/11. Coincidence? No, of course it's not a coincidence. Just like it's not a coincidence that a guy with deep links into the Chinese elite is currently the Treasury Secretary. I mean, of course, Hank Paulson, who made, I think it's like 70 or 80 visits to China to meet with his financial colleagues over there over the years. So this is a guy who's deeply connected with the Chinese elite. That's not a coincidence, and that ties us back into the issue of China. And of course, we've just had the Olympics. So we'll try and figure all that out for you in very simple terms that you don't have to be a financial genius to follow this stuff, and just lay out the underlying connections between all of these events. Now, it was only a few days ago that Nancy Pelosi was standing up there. And isn't it nice to see, by the way, the Democrats' asses hanging out there with only 98 of those Democrats opposing this versus 135 Republicans? I'm not celebrating that for reasons of wanting to be behind the Republicans, whose political stance on this is extremely self-serving. But no, it just highlights for the American people that who can you trust? Yeah, exactly. You can't trust the one-party, two-party state. But Nancy Pelosi saying, and this was a few days ago before the bailout was just voted down, she was saying, you know, the party is over for Wall Street. And there was a big spin attempt to indicate that the party was over. Well, no. Now the party's over for Wall Street, now that this thing has been voted down. But of course, the timing of all this is not accidental. This is a staged crash that you're watching taking place. Now, some of that staged issue is because it's staged for timing issues right now, and some of it is systemic. Let's take a look at the timing issues right now. You'll notice that this bill came before the House at a time when it wants to pack up camp and go off and do some electioneering. And that's not accidental. The idea was to try and do everything to put pressure on for a quick decision, to try and steamroll everybody into this decision. Now, how do they time that kind of stuff? Well, they timed it with the start of it was the raid on Bear Stearns. Now, Bear Stearns didn't just suddenly encounter problems and then have to be rescued. No, Bear Stearns was taken down. The people to focus on in this are, of course, JP Morgan Chase, kings of the derivatives mountain, and money launderers to the elite, especially the drug dealers, and Goldman Sachs, of course, Paulson's ex-firm. And these are the kind of institutional players who are the big sharks who are taking out small sharks. So what they did in the case of Bear Stearns was they the big investors, who by the way are as much a part of this as anything else, and you don't see a focus on the big investors, do you? Because they're making their moves through proxies, they're making their moves through derivatives, and they're profiting right now. But anyway, the big institutional players were used to leverage this, so they took out Bear Stearns by pulling money out of Bear Stearns, number one, and then denying liquidity to Bear Stearns and creating the problem. That was, if you like, a scene setter just to begin the period of deflation and begin the crisis. And everything that's happened since then has been a continuation of that process, where the big sharks are using derivatives and they're using put options. I mean, forget short selling. That's an extreme example of profiting on the downside. But a much less extreme example is simply using put options, and that's still there, and they're still deploying that. So you have wholesale market manipulation taking place on a scale similar to that in 1929, where once again there was manipulation of the market by the people who had the most money, those in a position to do it. So you have an unholy alliance here between the big institutional players in the markets and the government. Because if you know what way government policy is going to go, because hey, you've got your guys in the government and you are also the biggest players in the pond, then you can stage these kind of events. That's from a timing perspective. You'll notice also that we had a halt to the process for a few days there when John McCain suspended his campaign and went to Washington. It wasn't so much John McCain's campaign that was being suspended. The momentum towards the bailout was suspended so that Barack Obama and John McCain could do a pitch on the bailout to the reluctant peasants, who were none too happy at the idea of being shafted by their politicians and their investment wankers. So we had a lot of leading questions pitched by the host to both of the candidates along the lines of, you know, when the bailout goes through, what's your policy going to be afterwards? Trying to put a spin on this that, you know, it was a done deal. And so that resistance by the Republican conservatives, the fiscal conservatives, true blue Republicans, was a stunt in order to put a halt to the process. They're trying to put an ideological spin on this, that, you know, this is coming out of the conservative, fiscally conservative Republicans. It's not. The reason for the pause was the massive resistance on behalf of the American people to this, and the fact that the people in Washington know when they're up against it in terms of popular resistance to something, so they had to put a pause in there. And the cover that's been given to this is the resistance, ideological resistance of the Republicans. It's nothing to do with that. It's the resistance of the people which has brought this to a halt. Now, the second reason for the timing issue is the systemic reason, that it was as plain as the nose on your face that this housing bubble had to burst at some point, and that you would get around about 4, 5, 6, depends on how much you stoked it, and boy did they stoke it to milk it for everything that they could. It depends on how much you stoke this, how long you get out of a housing bubble. You could get as little as 4 or 5 years. You could push it to 6 or 7 years if you really tried hard. But it has certain intrinsic financial irreconcilables built into it. It's irreconcilable that you can end up having to pay so much of your hard-earned disposable income into a mortgage that you hardly have any money left for food. So that's the problem with any bubble, that once the bubble gets to a certain size, it starts to pull down disposable income, which starts to affect the economy, and then the thing is going to implode. There's just no two ways about it. It's going to crash. So these guys knew this thing was going to crash from a systemic point of view. The question was what their timing would be as to when they would begin the process of milking the American people for all of that loot. The ironic thing is that it's not as if they're not making a pile of money out of this crash anyway. That's the ironic thing. Yes, certain individual banks and investment banks, etc., are experiencing problems and going to the wall, etc. In effect, all that's happening is, as I say, the big sharks are eating the small sharks. I said that in the previous audio also. So they're actually making a whole pile of money. The people on the inside track on all this are making a pile. This is a cash cow crash which is going on. And how that's achieved is obviously on the put side. So what you got to do is bet individual stocks down and you can achieve your objectives. And the derivatives mountain itself is being used as a smokescreen. In there, in the derivatives mountain, which is between both the over-the-counter and private derivative trades, there is $1.5 quadrillion of derivatives. That's at their notional value. The underlying value, of course, is only a fraction of that in terms of percent, 3 to 5% of actual money. But it's all counter bets. So when you gross it up, it comes to $1.5 quadrillion at the moment. So in there, that is your haystack. And there are needles in that haystack. Those needles are the moves being made by the people in the know who are manipulating this system. And so they are making a pile of money out of this, even as the market tanks, etc. So, and in fact, that's a good place to simplify this for people who do not follow the financial markets and are not up to speed on the terminology or the nature of the investments, etc., etc. And that, of course, is one of the big factors playing in favor of the people manipulating the market, that the average person doesn't really understand in great complex detail all of this financial fluff which is floating around the system. But you can understand this. You know that these are called hedge funds. So that's a reflection of that term, hedging your bets. The derivatives system enables people to take part in financial transactions while at the same time covering their asses with a counter bet on the way the market will go, which will protect them should their guess as to what's going to happen with the market go wrong. Of course, you can also not bother with the original bet and just simply use the derivative in the first place to achieve your results. And this is especially true because of the fact, for example, with put options, that you can use a relatively small amount of capital to place a lot of bets. So derivatives are essentially a bet system to hedge your bets. And hedging your bets is insurance. For example, you could, well, take a guess that your house isn't going to burn down, but suppose it does, no more house. So it's a smart move to hedge your bets on that with some insurance, which you take out with an insurance company, and that insures you against your house burning down. So that's what a derivative is. It's an insurance function which is taking place in there. And one of the big scandals of this is that these large investment banks have been allowed to participate in insurance without the necessary capital behind them in order to guarantee that should something go wrong, they can actually pay out on the insurance. Now, the difference between the insurance that you would take out on your house and insurance in the financial markets is this. With a large enough catchment area, for example, the entire of the United States, well, it takes a heck of an event to generate insurance losses that the system can't handle. Hey, how many people's houses are going to burn down in the average week? It's pretty predictable, and you can write premiums based on that because you know what the risk is, and it's an isolated individual event that takes place. Of course, if you have your house in somewhere that's subject to bushfires, well, then maybe there's a higher premium needed there because it's not just your house that might burn down, it's the whole neighborhood could burn down. Alternatively, you see that at play again in Hurricane Katrina, for example. If the insurance in those kinds of areas are in Florida where the hurricanes hit too, it needs to be substantially higher, or they may not even offer you insurance at all because it's no longer an isolated event. That whole area could be hit with a destructive pattern which would cause so much damage that you would not be able to pay out on the insurance. Well, that's a minor problem in terms of containment of an event compared to what happens in financial markets, because in financial markets, if something goes wrong, it can take down every stock in the system. So there is no containment. So the people who are offering, in effect, insurance through the derivatives market, which really is an insurance market, were, well, they were cashing the checks they were getting as premiums, but they didn't have the ability to back it up with payouts. They couldn't possibly have ever had that ability unless that had been structurally built into the derivative system in the first place, and of course it wasn't. So you see, the fact that if there was a market correction, the entire system was going to come crashing down was entirely predictable, because you were never going to be in a position to pay out the insurance on the entire system coming crashing down. That was predictable. And if you factor in that all of the last years have been built on a housing bubble, which was surely going to bust, then clearly it was going to take the entire system down, and this was known. Now, people do not engineer, even greedy people do not engineer themselves into those kinds of situations unless there's something else that you don't know going on, because the outcome is predictable, isn't it? So, I mean, they're not that dumb. No, in fact, they're quite clever. And this is where it all ties in to 9/11 and to the process of globalization. You know, it's funny, when it came to the issue of 9/11, there was so much confusion and spin and disinformation and propaganda, and of course the shock which people were subjected to in the United States, that it became very, very difficult to fight them on the 9/11 issue. But it's interesting now that it's come down to bread and butter issues, which of course were always at the heart of the 9/11 issue, that, hey, now the great American unwashed masses, hey, they know that kind of bread and butter stuff. And so now the fight is truly on, and it does tie into 9/11. We'll get into that and into the nature of capitalism itself in order to understand systemically why this has happened in a few moments. We'll take a little break for music first, though. This is The Beautiful Truth on breakfornews.com with Fintan Dunn reporting, and we'll be right back.
Well, how many did you take? Beating yourself up for your mistakes. You know the punishment don't fit. When you weigh it up against a hit, guilty prayers pointless ends, pointless lessons, pointless friends. God knows I've wasted too much time chasing bad dreams out of my mind. At least you made it back home safe. I had my doubts when you left my place. I know our parting words were rushed. All talked out and all shut up. Guilty prayers, pointless ends, pointless lessons, pointless friends. God knows I've wasted too much time chasing bad dreams out of my mind. When the temperature rises, it takes its toll. you're left with a gaping midweek hole. Like that post office girl today, she said she was wishing a week away. Guilty plays pointless ends. Pointless lessons, pointless friends. God knows I've wasted too much time chasing bad dreams out of my mind.
And you're very welcome back. This is The Beautiful Truth on Break for News with Fintan Donnell reporting. Now we'll get into the systemic issues as to why this is taking place and what it's got to do with 9/11. But let me just lay one more thing on you about how this is a cash cow crash. We spoke just before the break there about the uninsurability of an area where it's likely that a lot of houses will burn down. You can't insure that kind of an area. At a standard rate, you've got to charge a higher premium. Well, of course, there have been problems in the past with properties burning down, especially properties owned by landlords, where the return they were getting was nothing like the value of the property, because the property had been insured for far more than it was actually worth in terms of income, or was worth on the open market. And so there was a bit of an epidemic of places burning down. And that was an insurance fraud. So sometimes it's more profitable to, if you can get away with it, to over-insure a place and then burn it down. The trouble is the cops tend to come calling if you pull that kind of a stunt, because the insurance company doing the payout isn't dumb, and there's a clear motive, and it's very visible. The problem is that in that same derivatives mountain, that 1.5 quadrillion volume of derivatives which have been written and are currently outstanding, that you can hide an awful lot of what? Insurance. Insurance on the very firms which are hitting the problems right now. And you actually can make money on the collapse. It's beautiful. So the right people who know exactly what's going on and who have the political and financial resources to manipulate the system, well, they're actually making a pile on this, even as they engage in this deliberate stage takedown of the system. Happening right now for timing reasons, and happening now for systemic reasons. We've looked at the systemic reasons going back as far as the creation of the housing bubble itself. And that's not as far back as we need to go. We need to go back a good bit further to understand what's going on and how it ties in to globalization and 9/11. And the systemic issues we need to look at go back as far as, well, what is capitalism and what are the upsides and downsides of capitalism? Now, capitalism claims to be an effective monetary system for social organization because of the fact that it produces a market and there is competition, etc., etc. Now, pure capitalism, well, it has some downsides. We could get into philosophical arguments about the downsides of capitalism. But capitalism is not what usually goes on. See, capitalism is better than the alternative, which is monopolistic, usually state control of an economic structure, which produces vested interests, which make sure that their interests are served against the benefit to the majority of the people. That's a monopoly, and usually a state-based monopoly, and this is what capitalism said it had triumphed over. Now, capitalism, by comparison to that, introduces the issue of competition, which is good. But the problem is that capitalism is very soon subverted into monopoly capitalism. I'll give you an example of monopoly capitalism at work, and how monopoly capitalism is actually the enemy of progress and not its friend. That example is the issue of Apple Computer, which was a relatively small company which benefited from pure capitalism to get some good ideas together and bring those ideas to market. And that's what Apple did successfully with the Apple II, and they proved that you could have something like a personal computer for everybody, which was a completely unheard of phenomenon until Apple Computer made it happen. Prior to that, computing was dominated by monopolistic interests, the greatest example of which was IBM. And so the field was stagnant because keeping that existing structure suited the monopoly interest. Well, when Apple came out with the Apple II and then moved on to a windowing system called the Apple Lisa, which preceded the Apple Macintosh, they were ready to carve some serious holes in that IBM monopoly. So IBM was forced to enter the market for personal computers. And with the kind of money that IBM had behind them, then big business figured, yeah, go with the big boys, because the big boys have got the money to make this stuff work. Apple are toast. And so Apple suddenly found that they could not sell their personal computers into the business market, and IBM virtually wiped them out. Almost. And of course, Bill Gates entered the picture as well. Now, Apple had been on the threshold of making a huge breakthrough into a windowing system with the Apple Lisa, years ahead of Microsoft Windows. But it never came to pass at that time, because monopoly capitalism moved in, and it is the enemy of progress. The true source of progress in terms of social organization and its efficiency is inventiveness. That's what brought Apple to the point they were at. And then we had the whole Windows thing, which, as you see, all these years later, in the calamity of Vista, was just monopoly capitalism at its worst. And no better monopoly than what Bill Gates has. So you see the difference between beneficial pure capitalism and monopoly capitalism, which is its enemy. Now, taking that issue back into history, and then quickly forward, I'm really going to fast forward through this stuff. The economies of Great Britain, Germany, France, Belgium, and others, and in recent years the United States, was built in the early days in the Industrial Revolution, particularly in the United Kingdom, by inventiveness, coming up with machines. Machines which could systematically produce product on a mechanized basis far more efficiently than human beings could do the same thing. And so the early inventors and the machines which they invented ended up being astonishingly lucrative for anybody who was in it, because it simply was a so much more efficient way of doing things. And countries like the United Kingdom prospered, built empires on the back of their ability to do the following, and usually with military might behind them: to take in raw materials from abroad, to fashion those raw materials into goods and sell those goods on their domestic markets, and then eventually into the foreign markets, and you made a pile of money. The problem was that other people could see what you were doing, and they could build machines too. Now, if they did that, you'd no longer be able to make the same margin, would you? Because now you've got competition. Well, that was solved in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. You simply wiped out anybody who tried to get in business and compete with you. re-establishing your monopoly control. But nevertheless, you can't stop progress forever. And so the process of invention continued and continued. But the difficulty was that, well, eventually you had to just yield ground and allow these people to have the same kind of machines as you had, bring in patent law and make a percentage off them in terms of a patent for your machine. And now you're still making a profit, but hey, it's nothing like the profit you used to make in the good old days, when a combination of military might and the fact that you owned all the machinery meant that you could cream it. Now your profit rate has dropped substantially, because you're just making a percentage on the fact that you're allowing other people use the machines you invented, and you're possibly selling them the machines. Yeah, so you can make some money. So it's not too bad, but your profit level has collapsed. Now fast forward that process, and you can see that as the world begins to go global in terms of human inventiveness and access to the machinery and the ability of every goddamn tin pot country in the world to start churning out consumer goodies, hey, profit is crashing now. And so capitalism and the profit which drives the, or satisfies, I should say, the greed of those who control the levers of capitalism has got a problem, because it's got a problem of diminishing returns on its investment. And as we've headed into a globalized world, that problem of diminishing returns has just grown and grown and grown. This is the systemic crisis which is facing capitalism, and particularly these greedy people who have their hands on the levers of capitalism and want to use it to their own benefit. Now, the people we're talking about are concentrated in the G8 countries of the world, the already developed international economies. And that's where you'll find the people who pulled off 9/11. So it was their problem that in a globalizing world where they could no longer control the access of people to the means of production, people around the world in other countries, they had an increasing problem of where to satisfy their lust for more and more money and power. Now, they used whatever means at their disposal they could, for example, going in using the IMF, etc., to deliberately tank economies around the world who might possibly compete with them. And in particular, the hard heart of this cabal is based in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in France, and in Germany. And so seeing this looming problem of global competition and their inability to dominate all global markets, they wanted to internationalize their power base, and that is the process known as globalization. The idea being that they could morph from being the G8, the powerful economies of the world, into a global structure which would control trade all over the world, and they would be able to use their political and financial power to morph themselves from a regional continental base to a global base. That's the process of globalization, and they were pulling that stunt because of running out of the ability to make such ludicrous profits off the backs of the people. Now, the way they were going to go about that was to engineer it out of what was at the time, and almost is, still the biggest economy in the world, the United States. And the mechanism for that was the dollar. So you had, during the presidency of Nixon, you had the abandonment of the gold standard and the move to the dollar itself as the international reserve currency. So they were going to use that to leverage their political power globally through the dollar. Now, the abandonment of the gold standard was not a bad idea per se, because it restricted the availability of capital for productive and inventive development. And so there are certain benefits to humanity coming from the abandonment of a system which restricted the availability of capital. Of course, the problem is that even in the full-blown dollar-based capitalism system, the effective monopolies mean that the average guy on the corner does not get funds at an appropriate rate which enables him to compete with these guys, because they have access to too much money, and it's effectively a monopoly. But however, the move to the dollar and then the reform which took place coincident with that, the reform of the financial system to loosen up the availability of capital, because it was seen as a good thing that it was time to create a middle class which would be prosperous, was a global phenomenon which did free up a lot of actual economic development globally. However, the sting was in the tail on this one, because these guys knew very well what the consequence would be of this internationalization of trade, this globalization process. If wage rates in the Western economies are 10 times what they are in the poor countries, and you internationalize, everybody is going to level out at a wage rate which is far below the wage rates which are current in the developed economies. That's simple logic. Nevertheless, these people figured that they could internationalize and consolidate their power at a global level before the peasants would realize what had happened. So, it was, in effect, a race between the capacity of the peasants to figure out what's going on and their ability to morph to the next level before everybody would catch them. And we're now approaching the issue of 9/11. But anyway, that takes us to, and it's a good point to get into the near-term past, to 1987 and the crash in October 1987, Black Monday. And that was a crash, and at the time I was involved as an advisor to an investment company which was handling a lot of big money for people, and so I was plugged into the markets, and that was a time when I used to have something to do with money, which I don't anymore, and certainly not since taking on trying to tell the truth about these people since 9/11 and before. But anyway, back in 87 we had that first crash of the modern financial system, and as it happens, I foresaw it, and we were in the markets up until the Friday beforehand, and certainly was gratifying having pulled out of the markets on the Friday. Yes, we rode that sucker all the way, to see a crash on the Monday and everyone running around like headless chickens trying to figure out what went wrong. And what went wrong, of course, was that the usual inflation game had been played. And what was the response of the US authorities to the crash? Well, it was to put liquidity into the market. And did they do that? They sure did. And those of us who knew underlying economic fundamentals watched in amazement as they continued to pour liquidity into the market, effectively inflating and inflating. Now, usually you can't inflate because there's a consequence to that in terms of its effect on your currency, but the United States has certain advantages there because they were the currency, the dollar. And so you could get away with it. And the other reason that you could get away with it is that all the other economies began to inflate in synchrony. They had to, in order to maintain some kind of stability of the currencies in the international system, they had to inflate also. And so we moved into this next phase, which, as I say, to the astonishment of those who knew the old economic fundamentals that applied in markets, we saw this continuing inflation and inflation and inflation, until these guys have been getting away with it for so long that everybody figured that this inflation system could keep going forever and it would always work. There is a problem, however, and it's an endemic systemic problem with capitalism. It's one of its downsides. Check out Adam Smith. You also need growth for capitalism to work at all. You need growth. If you go and read Adam Smith, you find out that that's the case. And how do you keep getting the kind of growth levels you need in an economy which is globalizing? It's a problem because you have all this competition and you're facing the surplus problem. You see, the world is awash in consumer goodies. The advantage of human inventiveness, whether it's the washing machine or whether it's the rotary engine or whatever it is, the advantage of that inventiveness is that it comes up with very efficient means of achieving certain things people need to do in their daily life, like get from A to B using a very nice, well-engineered car. And so everybody wants this stuff. But we have reached the limits of inventiveness under the current system because the monopolistic factors are making sure that further inventiveness, which would totally free people from the current economic structure, does not happen. And so they're stuck with the level of inventiveness which we are at, which means the usual consumer goodies, flat screen TVs and washing machines and cars. But what do you do in a world which is awash with these goods because everybody's making them, for their own domestic markets, and they're making them for export? And who are you going to export to? If everybody's making them, nobody's going to want to buy them from somebody else because everybody's got enough. Anyway, thank you. For their own domestic markets. And so as you begin to reach saturation, you've got a problem. You have got to find new territories to capitalize. In other words, to take their current systems of social organization and make a profit off them by injecting the new levels of machinery. But how do you do that when they can't afford it, when they're, you know, they're in the dirt and they don't have the money to participate in your capitalism? So you need an aggressive growth phase as much as you can, but for them, the problem is they still can't come up with enough growth. That's why you've seen the fall of the Berlin Wall. Nothing to do with politics and everything to do with needing to take all those Eastern European countries and begin to capitalize them in order to get the necessary growth, because this inflation growth pair are needed by capitalism, especially the monopoly variety, in order to survive. So there are these people with their objectives of achieving globalized control and the difficulty of needing to get sufficient growth in the interim and inflation to inflate the dollar. It's a tidal wave of dollar control washed out over the world in this inflationary period, which they were going to use that tidal wave to extend their power globally. Now, if something's flowing out from somewhere, it's going to leave a hole wherever it flowed from. And if that stuff is dollars, then that's going to leave a hole back right where they have some of their biggest problems. The biggest problem is that, hey, people in the United States, they actually believe in their country. They believe in the principles which were used to found their country, and they value their own national self-determination. And who can blame them? They're entitled to. Any group is entitled to do so. And they weren't going to necessarily like it if they found themselves a province of a global order. So the long-term issue was going to have to be faced at some point, which was that you were going to have to control the rowdy peasants back in the United States at some point in this game. You were going to have to, because of the equalization of wage rates, etc., etc. And that was always going to be a tricky one, and now we're getting even closer to the reasons for 9/11. So all of this stuff is predictable in terms of what's going to happen with the dollar. And that is why you had the euro set up in 2000, beginning to trade in 2000. Why? Because they knew what's coming down. They knew what's coming down with the dollar, and you couldn't implode the world's reserve currency and not have any effects. It would definitely have effects. You needed to begin to offload to regional global economic centers. And Europe, of course, was one of those centers. Well, no surprise, because the German Bundesbank controls the euro. And as I said a little earlier, the heart of control, which is doing this stuff to us, is in Germany, France, Great Britain, and the USA. So the Germans got their euro, an essential preparatory stage in 2000 to enable this globalization process. Once again, as I say, they know the dollar is going to blow. So the euro is set up in order to soften that so that there will be capital somewhere else. Now, where else did they make the move? As I said at the beginning of this audio, just a couple of weeks after 9/11, China was admitted to the World Trade Organization. And these people want to globalize, and China's a huge market. It's the key market outside of Europe. Europe's already strangled with the tax rate, the GDP in Europe. 45% of every 100 euro is government spending. In the United States, by comparison, it's 30%. Even with the huge growth in the federal government, etc., and everybody saying, oh, Washington's too big and it's in our face, wow, you should be in Europe. And you see what government in your face is, with the 45 out of every 100 euros is been spent by the government. And that is, as you can imagine, grossly inefficient. And therefore, Europe, limited potential there for them. But of course, China, an emerging market, they definitely wanted into that market. And so many people know this, that the scheme was for the Chinese to be allowed access into the United States. They're going to manufacture very cheap, then they're going to reinvest in the United States. So there's a cozy cartel going on, and essentially that dollar flood, although it doesn't appear in terms of actual currency moves, but what's actually happening is the dollar flood was directed into China, which enabled the Chinese to lever themselves into the international economy using that flow of capital. And that's, of course, why the China move was made just after 9/11. So after a while of China doing that for long enough, they now are developing what we call the infrastructure of capitalism. And so they reach a point where eventually, hey, they can cut the umbilical cord to the mothership. You know what I mean? And they're up and running, dude, thanks to that infusion of dollars. And the last event, which, if you like, copper fastened that inflation stroke creation of the Chinese economy, was the Olympics, which we just had, which was like a government investment program, which was going to generate economic benefits because of the capital which is being put into development, into building stadiums, etc., which is the final piece of fluff into the Chinese system to kick it into full gear. And as I say, time to cut the umbilical cord to the mothership, because now China's up and running, baby. And hey presto, no sooner are the Olympics out of the way than suddenly the economic problems start to hit in the United States. Do you see what I mean about how this is macroeconomics at work? This is the macroeconomics of globalization at work, and it's entirely predictable. So why did 9/11 happen? We have this coincidence between the 9/11 event and the admission of China. It happened for a lot of strategic reasons. I mean, one of the strategic reasons was that in an era where, despite the inflationary bubble, right, which is going on, that you are still, you know, you're going to have systemic problems. In other words, this morphing to the globalized stage is going to create some problems. So 9/11, as you've seen in what they just tried to do right now, was about pumping money into the military-industrial complex sector of the American economy. Why? To strengthen it with profit ahead of the coming difficulties. And also the big airlines got money back at 9/11. You remember that as well. So they were pumping money into the favored areas of the economy. And in the United States, the favored areas is the big car business, the airline business, the defense business, and the financial sector. They're currently trying to pump a whole pile of money into the financial sector to fatten it up, because the lean years are coming. So all of that stuff, pouring money in to the financials with the bailout plan and pouring money into the defense industries back at 9/11, was about building up their strength, fattening them up in advance of the lean years to come. If you're on the inside track on this, and if you're part of the elite, then they're going to look after the biggest boys, and so the biggest boys were getting looked after. Another reason was that it was going to take everybody's eye off the ball, and it was going to enable them to bring in the legislation which affects civil liberties, because, hey, they need that stuff there as a fail-safe in case it all goes horribly wrong for them, so that they can, well, crack down. So those are really good strategic reasons right there, priming the defense area with a 9/11 event, and getting all those laws on the books so that you can teach the peasants some lessons if they decide that they don't like what's happening. So those are the structural economic reasons. But of course, there's also the issue of getting people off balance. And these people are PSYOP experts, and they know the process of manipulation of human emotions and human behavior, because they got some of the best brains in the business studying this stuff for years. So it would get people off balance, was the other thing. It would take their eye off. You remember, prior to the 9/11 event taking place, there was this anti-globalization movement, which was causing a lot of political turmoil for them. Now, they actually moved in into the anti-globalization movement and steered it to their own ends. They put in agent provocateur into the movement to throw rocks through windows, etc., and give the police an opportunity to crack down and give anti-globalization protest a bad name. That's standard operational procedure stuff. And then they engineered the battle in Seattle, which was where they just kicked the crap out of the anti-globalization people. And, that was the definitive crackdown. They wanted to get that globalization crackdown in before the 9/11 event. So that's why that took place then. Take those people out of the picture, and then very quickly move everything to a security focus and freak everybody out and grab the agenda away from the issue of globalization and onto the issue of security and terrorism. And that issue of grabbing the agenda is key, that you must grab the news agenda. so to speak. And so that's why you have all that focus on terrorism, because you're simply gobbling up time when people might be discussing rationally the processes which are going on in their society and then responding accordingly. So it's bandwidth theft is what you're in the business of when you're doing that. You are feeding people stuff that you're going to occupy them with. That's another big reason for the whole global warming thing, is that you're just going to suck so many column inches into these created news stories and political agendas that there isn't time left to discuss the other stuff. And what they don't want people doing is zoning out of discussing anything to do with terrorism, Al-Qaeda, or any of that stuff, zoning out of global warming or any of that, and starting to concentrate on the bread and butter issues and beginning to develop themselves politically. And of course, they're also then using that hysteria to ping-pong you between the two parties, the nasty dictator party and the people-loving democratic party. So that game goes on too. And finally, they know. And as Bush advised everybody to do, go out and shop, shop, shop. Because they know that that kind of an event produces a hysterical reaction in people on a mass level, especially if you then prime it with a huge inflation, which enables another wave of dollars to be washing out from the United States to fund the military adventures abroad and the investment into the defense sector. So you had a circular reinforcing system taking place there. And then the housing bubble, which was essential, because what they're doing during this process, and now they're really moving into gear, as I say, bringing the Chinese in, starting to wash the dollars out into China as well. So they're making their move. That's when you have the outsourcing starts to kick in, and that's when you have the transfer of productive manufacturing out of the United States. Now, if you did that without a bubble economy, the pain of that would be felt fairly soon, because you're missing all those jobs which, you know, are now being outsourced, and you don't have that productive manufacturing capacity anymore. So productive manufacturing capacity actually is the root of the tree. You know, all this froth, cable television companies and financial systems and all the rest, that's all froth. You know, the basic core of it is your actual hardcore ability to manufacture basic goods, your steel, your foodstuffs, all that. That is the hardcore. And they were moving that abroad and they were outsourcing jobs. And if you did not have a bubble during that process, the pain would be felt immediately. However, by creating an inflationary bubble in the housing sector, which they knew was only going to last so long, they could create the illusion of a continuing economic performance, which was, as I say, entirely illusory, because it's a bubble-based system. It's not based on actual, you know, the ability to produce stuff and sell it to somebody else. If, as at a national level, if you're a country, you've got to be able to sell the stuff abroad, is key to your economic growth. And that simply wasn't going to happen, not in the new environment. So they had to create an artificial bubble to mask the asset stripping of the United States as they moved into this final phase. Now, they know the housing bubble is going to burst, but they're carefully monitoring the system. They've got their plunge protection team. They've got this huge mountain of derivatives. They've got a dollar printing machine. They've got the cooperation of other central banks, especially the ones in the large economies who are colluding in this process of globalization and the theft of their national resources from the people of the United States. And so there is an entire array of financial structures which is creating this bubble, and they know it's going to blow. As I said, it's going to blow, because eventually, you know, whether it's tulips you're investing in or houses you're investing in, you know, so much of your money is locked up in that, that it starts to affect your ability to buy other stuff. And as they're starting to strip the assets out, eventually it comes to a point where, hey, it's going to implode. They know this, and they're just managing the timing. And they're pretty good at this, managing the timing of it at a systemic level. And the plan was to come in and take the first bite at you, just grab the first, just to establish the modus operandi, because this is not the end of it. It's not a subprime problem. There is a subprime problem which generated the initial problems, but that's only like the tip of the iceberg. In other words, the outright fraud, where you're, you know, giving mortgages to people who hardly even exist, let alone have the capacity to undertake to pay those mortgages on a 25-30 year basis, especially as the economy is about to go down the tubes. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. The rest of it is that all of it is built on this bubble because, hey, if you are collapsing economically, where's the Chinese going to be able to sell their goods to if the United States is having this systemic problem? Hey, the game is up, and they know the game is up, but the idea was to come in, grab that first tranche of $700 billion, and it was open-ended, by the way, so they could sort of keep that going. But even more importantly, they would establish the paradigm of state intervention. This is the idea. And then what you are scheduled to have next in their plan, well, as I say, come in. They keep their options open, so they can give you Obama or they can give you McCain, because it's finely balanced between the two, depending on how things are going. But the original plan is to give you McCain, to come in, yeah, take the $700 billion and establish the paradigm of state intervention, give you McCain, and then the shit hits the fan. And it's the Republicans who take the hit on that, because they're engineering towards a 2012 revolution in the United States where full democracy comes to the people, if you believe that. But of course, it will be a Mac democracy, completely controlled by the global corporate system now. But nevertheless, I feel like an orange revolution for the United States is scheduled for 2012, and you're due to get McCain in the meantime. Plus also, you know, with McCain there, they can then keep going with the Republican bad guys stuff. And then the Republican Party, due to be buried in 2012 as this big wave of populism, and also the fact that people are totally cheesed off at having been screwed so badly, means they have to, you know, let some steam out of that and bring in a Democratic administration. But they're keeping their options open depending on which way this goes. But anyhow, the sting in the tail of all this, and you can already see mention of it, and some people in the forum on breakfornews.com are well onto this stuff and have their eyes peeled for it, talk of a new economic order. A new economic order. A new world order in finance, which will have to emerge out of the ruins of this. But that sort of stuff is scheduled for 2009, you know, when all that stuff's going to hit. And so, wow, would that advance the process of globalization? I mean, who can argue anymore with the need for a global structure? Because the current structure has failed, folks. We've got no choice. We've got to move to a global financial structure, which, of course, is vital underpinning for global political control, the global agenda, the one world government system. Yeah, that is the plan. So they are knowingly, because everybody in the who was the macroeconomic strategists behind this globalization move knew how all this is going to go, and they know it's going to tank, and they know they will then come forward and say, oh, we need a whole new system to get everybody working again, to restart the global economy, and it's going to be a global one. So if you like, that's leapfrogging over the process of creating the euro and the Amero, for example, and then eventually consolidating these into a global currency. Now, they jump straight over the top of that and go right for the global currency because everybody's screaming, hey, we need something done with the economy. And so the answer is a global system, global control, global economic control. And that puts these boys in the driving seat at a global level, in the driving seat of global capital, which is global control under capitalism. And that is our run, our fast forward, consolidated into a shorter period of time as I can, touching all the salient points all the way from the Industrial Revolution to the Olympics, with 9/11 in between as an intrinsic strategic part of it. And you know what I like about this is that now you're tying simple bread and butter issues into 9/11 in a comprehensible fashion to the average person in the street. It's got nothing to do with thermite or space beams or anything else. It's simply global strategic maneuvering by these people, of which the 9/11 event is now seen and can be seen in the context of those global economic macroeconomics. And I think that makes 9/11 comprehensible to the average person in a way that all of the issues we've had to talk about up until now haven't. You see, we knew this was coming. Anybody who's been in on the 9/11 event with a brain has seen all this coming, and for those of us who have been, and I know many on Break for News are, when we saw Greenspan go and Bernanke put in his place and a number of other key central bankers in the Federal Reserve System resigned at the same time, we knew what these guys were going to do. We knew that when Greenspan was pulling out, you're looking at about a couple of years until they tank the system. So, but, you know, it's one thing, you can predict that and say it to people, they're not going to bother listening. No, because, hey, it's bubble economy time, and you can't get their attention because you're starting to argue, oh, no, the tariffs couldn't have fallen this way and that way, and you can't rely on the, hey, bread and butter issues that show you how 9/11 fits into this globalist macroeconomic structure. But now you can. So maybe that's a renewed opportunity for you to speak to your friends, neighbors, and others about the rationale for the 9/11 system and the fact that China got admitted to the World Trade Organization just days after, and the fact that the Chinese economy has been inflated with US dollars ever since, and the fact the Olympics just took place, the final event to copper fasten the independent existence of the Chinese economic structure, and Hank Paulson's 72 visits to China and his close ties to the Chinese elite. And hey, if the guys and gals that you talk to can't figure it out, from Paulson, China, 9/11, WTO, Olympics, and the flight of productive capacity out of the United States into the rest of the world through the dollar and then the eventual tanking of the dollar, well, then the two don't forget them. But hey, a lot of people will get it on that level who couldn't get it before and who couldn't see what was going on and for whom the terrorism thing just confused everything. This is bread and butter stuff. So that's a positive, that 9/11 can now be contextualized in ways that it couldn't be before all the stuff that those of us who saw this coming were predicting and predicting and predicting, but not managing to get people's attention because it hadn't happened yet. Now it's happened. That's the good side. The downside is that, well, you know, we're into the critical time now. We're this is crunch time now. And so this is a very tricky time. And the stakes are rising all the time, never more so than now. And so you need to be fleet of foot, and you need to be paying attention to what's going on, and you need to be active. There's no point in just listening to the stuff on Break for News. You need to get it out there in terms of analysis of what's going on. You need to start pushing it out into what I think will now be a more receptive audience. And bear in mind that the deep nature of the 9/11 event, etc., etc., there's a lot of fake sites out there. We named 108 of the goddamn sites. So you can bet your ass that the kind of analysis you get here on breakfornews.com, it's not going to get out through them. So you're going to have to post it in forums on the net. Don't bother with the big ones. Don't bother with Above Top Secret or Rigorous Intuition or the Alex Jones website, InfoWars, posting it on there. Because it'll be deleted as quick as it's posted if you mention Break for News. Believe me, in minutes, less. So you're going to have to go to smaller forums if you want to try and get the word out on this. And you're going to have to use emails to get it out to people and ask them to get the word out too. But it's definitely time to be working on those kinds of issues. Otherwise, people will continue to run in circles and not know exactly what it is they're fighting. They need to know that. It's good that they're fighting. It's good that the pressure from the American people has put a monkey wrench into this plan. And now it's a different ball game we're in. But hey, it's only getting interesting, as the guy said. And speaking of interesting, another good question is what is money? Maybe time to get into that. We need another audio to get into that, because it's at this stage we need to start asking ourselves, well, okay, what is capital? What is money? Why do we need it? Who should be in control of it? What's its best use? What's the relationship between money and inventiveness and productivity? What do we need to be doing, and where do we need to go, and how does money fit into all of that? Because these are the kind of systemic questions we need to answer anyway, and we need to be armed with the right arguments, because there will be a globalist system bullshit version of what money is which will be coming at us, and we need to be able to address that. But as I say, interesting times. But we leave it there for this edition of The Beautiful Truth on breakfornews.com. I will be back very shortly with more, and I do hope that you can join me for that. But in the meantime, for breakfornews.com, this has been Fenton Dunn reporting.
please keep me warm. Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Will you always keep me warm? Hold me safe and away from harm. Keep day for night, and as the day fades, burn a candle right for me. Walking into the sun. Walking into the sun.
Keep me warm, hold me safe and away from.